put this in as hypocrisy meant is somewhat different, I think, than what we would ordinarily think. Hypocrisy is a term that's being applied here to those who worship God out of a slavish, forced fear, only because they're extorted to it by the judgment of God. I'm really glad Calvin put this section in. In this last year, I've been witnessing to a very pleasant elderly individual who has been explaining to me some of his problems with Christianity. And one of the first ones he brought out is, it seems like Christianity is a matter of extortion, that if you don't do the right things, then God's going to get you. God's going to judge you. Calvin deals with this. He says, you know, you don't have true reverence for God if you only follow him out of slavish fear of his final judgment. Calvin speaks, first of all, of that voluntary fear that arises out of reverence for the divine majesty. Voluntary fear arising out of reverence for the divine majesty. There's an obedience that's given to God, not out of fear of the consequences of disobedience, but an obedience that's willingly given because we respect the glory of God. We say, God, you're so good and you're so great that I want to do what you say is right, because I respect you, not because I'm afraid that if I don't, I'm going to get it in the end. And so Calvin contrasts these two ideas of fear of God, and he says the slavish, forced fear of God that is extorted by extorted because of fear of God's judgment is not true religion. It's hypocrisy. How do we know it's hypocrisy? Well, at least those that Calvin is referring to are described as those who know that his judgment seat stands ready to punish transgressions against him, yet they greatly desire to its overthrow. Feeling so, they wage war against the Lord, who cannot be without judgment. They perform some semblance of religion. Meanwhile, they do not desist from polluting themselves with every sort of vice and from joining wickedness to wickedness until in every respect they violate the holy law of the Lord and dissipate all his righteousness. They indulge their fleshly intemperance rather than restrain it by the bridle of the Holy Spirit. You correct me if you read this differently, but I think Calvin's talking about people here who go through a little religious ritual to kind of placate God. They have to go and go to Mass, if I can pick on the Roman Catholics for a minute. I grew up with a lot of Roman Catholics that I think fit this description beautifully. They go through this little, they say their Hail Marys, they'll do the penance the priest tells them, but their hearts are not changed at all. And you talk about the most wicked people in town, the people who are the town drunks, who are, you know, sleeping around with everybody. They're the ones who get up and go to early Mass on Sunday morning. They go through a religious ritual because they don't want to face the judgment of God, but they give themselves to dissolute living. Now, it's not just Roman Catholics, don't misunderstand me. But because I lived in a Roman Catholic community, I mean, this immediately struck me. People who just don't restrain their lives at all, and yet there is a time for religion, because they don't want to have that terrible judge send them to purgatory or to hell. They do their little religious thing every once in a while. Is that the way you take what Calvin's saying here? That's right. That's right. And if somebody could convince them there isn't going to be a day of judgment, they'd love it. That'd be even better. It's kind of like, I want to go to heaven, but live like hell. And it'd be a lot better if I didn't have to worry about either. Yeah, I think you're right.
If the word hypocrisy you used correctly, wouldn't the word hypocrisy drop from the one kind of hypercraft, I guess it was called, a group of actors that went around and did it for billions and stuff like that, and the idea is that they were portraying something they were not.
Yeah, well, that,
acting.
The Greek word hypocrite means an actor, the person who puts on the mask on the stage,
right.
Who is not what he portrays himself as being.
People are not acting.
Well, in a sense they are. Let's take the Roman Catholic. He goes to Mass. You might look out your window some Sunday morning, see this guy getting up early, going to Mass, and coming back and say, well, he's a very religious man.
But that's your perception. I'm talking about what's in his heart. Is he acting to himself? An actor knows he's acting.
In self-deception, however, I always come back to that for some reason. In self-deception, people can be acting out things and get so caught up in the play that they forget that they're acting. Yeah, well, there are actors who have said in love scenes, for instance, that they forgot that they were acting. They were really throwing themselves into this situation. I don't believe that the people who get up and go to early Mass, and even though they live dissolute lives, would say, I'm being a hypocrite. Because if they would say that to themselves, they wouldn't bother to get up and go to Mass. They really think that they're being religious. And some of the most notorious mob figures in the history of the United States have been devout Roman Catholics. That doesn't say a lot about Roman Catholic devotion, perhaps. But the point is, they pay their money to the church, they make grand contributions, they go to Mass, and if you ask them, they'd say, I'm a Roman Catholic. They would dare let you insult the Virgin Mary. Yes, sir? I think that's a good comment. Yes, probably so. There is in their theology, in their way of looking at life, a natural. A tendency to divide things into religious and secular, grace and nature, and so they might go through their grace and religious motions on Sunday, but in the realm of nature. How their people in society or their family or use of money or vocation, they might not see a direct connection. Calvin is not going to accept this as religion either. Notice at the bottom of page 50, he says, the piety from which religion takes its source is instilled in the breast of believers only. He's very exclusivistic. He says, only believers in Jesus Christ have the genuine piety from which religion arises. Oh, and on top of 51 is where that language of paltry sacrifices comes in. They boldly rebel against him in almost all their deeds and are zealous to placate him merely with a few paltry sacrifices. He speaks of their ridiculous acts of expiation. Which leads me to think that he's talking about more than just the Roman Catholics. He's probably talking about pagan religions because they have their acts of expiation and sacrifice. Yeah. Packer talks about pagan views of expiation in his book Knowing God, and he says that the pagan view is one of offering a gift to bribe God, a callous commercialism, he calls it, to kind of buy him off. The Christian view is that Christ has placated the wrath of God by satisfying his justice. It's not just a matter of trying to bribe him, buy him off. Calvin's right. You have these paltry sacrifices, ridiculous acts of expiation. And notice how he again, I certainly respect the insight, sensitivity of Calvin here. He says, while their trust ought to have been in him, they neglect him and rely upon themselves. He goes to the very heart of the matter. No matter what religion you're talking about, whatever pagan view of expiation you have, the fact is, you know it's not religious because they're not relying on God. They're not saying, God, if I'm a sinner, obviously the only way I'll be saved is by whatever method you provide. I can't devise a way of placating you. I can't buy you off. The only hope I have is your grace. So Calvin points out that they can't have genuine religion because, again, it leads away from humility toward human pride and vanity. And I couldn't help but think of modern movie portrayals of God, whether it's the big screen or just television portrayals, when Calvin in this last paragraph says, in tranquil times they wittily joke about God, indeed are facetious and garrulous in belittling his power. If any occasion for despair presses upon them, it goads them to seek him and impels their perfunctory prayers. There are two things going on here. They're wittily joking about God and then their perfunctory prayers. And this is what the modern world, it seems to me, would have us think about God. God's something kind of for humor. I mean, you have people who actually have the audacity to play the part of God. It's kind of a kindly old man who is, he's got a lot of power, but just not sure he wants to run the world anymore. This is George Burns' conception of God. And we think God is the subject for cute little jokes like that. People don't hesitate to, you have this Xerox commercial, you know, where you have the monk looking up to heaven, so forth. That may not be, that's a fairly innocuous example you'd think of, but that just goes to show you how far we'll go. Xerox is willing to sell copiers by appealing to some, you know, conception of deity like that. Well, anything that's beyond our natural ability is in the realm of the divine, yes.
There's a new TV show on Showtime called Steam Room, where people die and go to this place, and God is a television janitor.
Terrific. Terrific. Well, that's what I'm talking about. Right? And then also this reference to perfunctory prayer. Last evening I was watching TV after church, and again we had a scene where this couple is praying over their dinner, and while the woman is praying, naturally the man is too tough to see somebody who prays, while the woman is praying, he is looking at what she's getting ready to serve. I think he's reaching for a roll or something like that, and she looks up and slaps his hand. And we're also saying, isn't that cute? Uh-huh. And when she gets done, he says, listen, while you're talking to him, why couldn't you have asked for a new tractor or something like that for him? Perfunctory prayers and little witty ideas of God. And we think we're cutesy, and God is insulted. And Calvin, in this case, I think being a godly man, is insulted for the sake of his Creator when people treat the majesty and holiness of God in this way. Hypocrisy toward God. Okay, let me summarize then what he has just said. He says, we cannot conceive of God according to our own whim. That's section 3. Vague and erroneous opinions of the divine are ignorance of the true God. Not just any religion will do, but only true religion will do. For God is not some kind of ghost to be transformed according to anyone's whim. The true worship of God in superstition is rejected by some in favor of adoration of their own vain ideas. So that when you forsake God, Calvin says, you're left only with idols. And no religion is genuine, he says finally, unless it's joined with truth. And then on hypocrisy, he says the false religion that results from slavish, forced fear of God's judgment is such that men are led to want to overthrow God in his judgment, but realizing they cannot do this, out of dread they perform some semblance of religion, and despite their pretended fear of God, at the same time their lives are but vicious and wicked. He then contrasts true and false godliness, saying, the rebellious at heart pretend obedience to God in their paltry sacrifices and trumped-up observances, but their lives are marked by sheer immorality, because their trust is not really in God the Creator, but in themselves the creatures. And this results in spiritual blindness. The innate awareness of the divine, while not lost, is still utterly corrupted by them. And to sum up, the sense of deity naturally engraven on human hearts is evidenced by the reluctant and perfunctory prayers extracted from the godless in times of spiritual crisis. Yet their stubbornness prevents the sense of deity from leading them to true religion. Okay, a lot there in chapter 4, which was entitled, This Knowledge is Either Smothered or Corrupted, Partly by Ignorance, Partly by Malice. Now chapter 5 says, The knowledge of God shines forth in the fashioning of the universe and the continuing government of it. He's talked about the way men corrupt the knowledge of God, and he's going to argue now that the knowledge of God is still there shining forth so that we are without excuse for all of these evasions and these mistakes. The first 10 sections of chapter 5 deal with God being manifested in his created works. Section 1, the clarity of God's self-disclosure strips us of every excuse. Calvin says, the final goal of the blessed life rests in the knowledge of God. What is our highest privilege in life? What is the end for which we are saved? What is the end for which we are made? The knowledge of God. And in this particular case, I think the editor's reference to Augustine, Aquinas and Augustine, is particularly apt. Many in the history of the church have said things to this effect, that the knowledge of God is the final end of life. Notice that Calvin says, lest anyone then be excluded from access to happiness, he not only sowed in men's minds that seed of religion of which we have spoken. This is what we've been talking about all along, the sensus deitatis, the sense of God which is in every man. But now as well has revealed himself and daily discloses himself in the whole workmanship of the universe. In a word, Calvin is distinguishing between the internal and the external natural or general revelation of God. God has made himself known internally. That's what we have been discussing. But now he's going to talk about how God is seen in the created world. He has made reference to that, but for the most part he's talking about that knowledge of God which is suppressed within man. He's been dealing with an internal kind of revelation of God that he calls the seed of religion or the sense of deity that is within every man. And now he turns to the external manifestation of God's being and work in the universe itself. Yes. Right. Right.
And when that seed of religion remains, can't be uprooted. But this seed is so corrupted by something worse.
Yeah, elsewhere, remember, he uses the image of it having fat all around it. There's a seed of religion there, but we become dull to it. We either corrupt so it doesn't grow properly, or it's kind of lost its power because we're so spiritually obtuse. But the seed of religion cannot ever be extracted from man. And that's in our lesson tonight, a statement to that effect. It may be further down. But anyway, you're right. He says that no man is truly an atheist because all have the seed of religion in them. Now I'm going to I'm going to lay out before you a controversy in Calvinistic apologetics, and I'd like you to be especially sensitive to this as you read and as we talk about this particular section of Calvin. Tell me which position Calvin really took. There are those who say that Calvinists who say Calvin taught natural theology, by which they mean Calvin believed that the natural man with his natural abilities could look at the natural world and could infer some truths about God. That he could take the evidence of the natural world and concoct arguments that would lead him to the conclusion that there must be a God of such and such a nature. Other Calvinists would say, no, that is not what Calvin, or Paul for that matter, taught, but rather they teach natural revelation, that God displays himself through the created world so that men immediately know their creator when they look at the world. It's not that they look at the world and say, you know, I think there's material here from which we could build an argument that there's a God. That is to say, some believe that in the natural world, we come to a discursive knowledge of God, whereas others believe we come to an immediate knowledge of God. Let me contrast discursive knowing and immediate knowing. A good example is when we drove in tonight, I saw Jim's car sitting here. And because he's had that car for some time and I've had close contact with his life, when I looked at that car and expected, you know, that Jim was going to be at the class tonight, I just said, Jim's here. I recognize his car. Okay, now, I did not discursively go through kind of thing. There are a lot of white cars like that in this world. However, not many would be going to the class tonight, although it's possible that somebody working in that building has it, and therefore it's very probable that that is Jim's car. See, I didn't go step by step through a syllogism or through the evaluation of various hypotheses and then come to a conclusion. I just said, Jim's here already. I immediately recognized it. Now, that may not be the best example of immediate recognition. When I look at Jim right now, I say, that's Jim Andrus right there. I don't do that by going, ah, it's the nose. It's the nose that does it. When you have that nose and a white car in the parking lot and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, I can discursively, step by step, come to the conclusion that's Jim Andrus. No, I just recognize Jim Andrus. Now, in the realm of religion and natural revelation, is Calvin saying when unbelievers look at the world, they have all the evidence for saying, well, there's this and there's that, and if we reason logically, we come to the inference, there must be a God? Or is he rather saying, God has so visually displayed himself in the creation that men immediately see his trademark? They say, this was made by God. Now, I maintain that Paul, and Calvin reflecting Paul, taught the immediate knowledge of God through revelation in the natural world, and not what is called natural theology. That if you could just use your powers of logic and perception, you could devise a good argument for the existence of God.
You're taking the medieval approach.
No, I'm arguing against the medieval approach of Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas would say, look, everybody can look at the world and they see there's motion. From where I am, that's immediately evident because I see cars moving out here on the street. And from the fact of motion, if we reason correctly about it, we must say there's a first mover, which we call God. So you see, he doesn't say, looking at the world, it's evident that God made it. He says, rather, looking at what we see in the world, we can reason back to God eventually.
Could that would make a case that your immediate knowledge of reasoning is really just proof of reason is very, very, very bad?
That's a possibility. However, at some point, that becomes a rather contrived explanation because it's so automatic and so universal. I mean, somebody is really holding on to a theory of human psychology when he says, well, you really are going through a step-by-step reasoning process. It's just that it's so instantaneous you don't see the steps. Well, what's the difference between an immediate recognition of something and not being able to go through the steps? I couldn't tell you what the steps are. I look at Jim and I say, that's Jim.
Then there are other things we learn how to do with our hands, but we don't learn that discursively.
Yeah, I'm not sure that riding a bike is learned discursively.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that's one of those abilities people have, and they grasp it in its wholeness rather than step by step. It's not like first you learn to hold the handlebars, then you learn to balance yourself, then you learn to pedal. No, it's you learn to hold the handlebars, pedal, and balance all at the same time. Now you know how to ride a bike.
Without knowledge.
No, I would say it is knowledge. It's a knowledge how.
Can you correct me on something? I might have the wrong view. It was my idea that in medieval times, before the Renaissance, people thought in very spiritually. Everything was associated spiritually somehow. Everything that happened. At least the book that I read said this.
Okay.
And after the Renaissance, post-Renaissance time, more like what you're talking about, with, you know, this is this way because of that and that and that and that and that.
Well, I think the more accurate way to put it is all through the medieval period, you have two types of theology. One's mystical theology that believes that God is known in a kind of a spiritual, mystical, and mysterious way.
In medieval times.
But also you have those philosophers of religion who taught that you could reason to God, like Thomas Aquinas, who had proofs for the existence of God. You have both. You have those who say we don't need rational proofs. We have a direct apprehension of God, especially during times of religious devotion, where our minds rise. We get outside of our mind, and we have kind of a feeling of the divine majesty.
This was an argument brought forth, I think, by tracing our history. And in medieval times, everything was spiritual, virtually. Everything had something to do with it. All painting had to do with that. And then after the Renaissance, you got into, you know, landscape architecture and that kind of thing, that they started painting, so they became more acquainted with their earth. But it was a much more spiritual time.
That may be a generalization that's true in art history, but it wouldn't be true, I think, in the history of philosophy.
Okay. Do you know if Calvin would say that the general revelation is immediate or descriptive to the immediate? Would they rule out the immediate?
They are kind of, and I get the impression that when they're arguing their case in popular audiences, they're really talking about natural revelation. They go to Romans 1 and this sort of thing, and they talk about how everybody is able, you know, to see God in creation. It says so right here. But then when they bring it over into apologetics, they talk about natural theology. They mean Thomas Aquinas and the proofs of God's existence should be used by us. But I don't think that Paul in any sense meant that. And I really think if you pay attention to Calvin, he didn't either. Let me try to give you some demonstration or reason to believe that interpretation of Calvin is right. Look at section 2 of chapter 5. He says, the divine wisdom is displayed for all to see. There are innumerable evidences, both in heaven and on earth, that declare his wonderful wisdom. Not only those more recondite matters for the closer observation of which astronomy, medicine, and all natural science are intended, but also those which thrust themselves upon the sight of even the most untutored and ignorant persons, so that they cannot open their eyes without being compelled to witness them. Skip a sentence. Yet ignorance of them prevents no one from seeing more than enough of God's workmanship in his creation to lead him to break forth in admiration of the artificer. Down a few sentences, only by the aid of the eyes, he says, been taught only by the aid of the eyes, cannot be unaware of the excellence of divine art. What I'm suggesting is that Calvin emphasizes a direct seeing of the majesty of God in creation. And he says, while it helps to know a lot about medicine and astronomy and all these things, and that will improve, in a sense, or deepen your appreciation that God's the author of all these things, he says, even the untutored and the ignorant, if they only know how to use their eyes, have to come to a knowledge of God. You see, it's a direct perception of the majesty of God in creation. The fact that they're unlearned, that they haven't got an education, shows that they couldn't possibly be expected to follow the Thomistic proofs. I mean, even those who have got an education have a tough time following that. I mean, if our philosophy majors can't even get Thomas right, how can we expect Sophie the washwoman to do this? And yet the point is, everyone, the most unlearned or not, everyone can see the majesty of God in creation. And so I maintain that Calvin's not talking about natural theology. He's talking about natural revelation. Let me go through this section a little slower. We're going to run out of time here and have to come back to chapter 5. It's pretty clear, so I won't expect to get to the end. This sentence at the top of page 52 is another one in line with what I've just said. He says, as a consequence, men cannot open their eyes without being compelled to see him. I'm going to change the subject now, though, because in this next sentence he says something which is interesting and significant. Indeed, Calvin claims, God's essence is incomprehensible. Hence, his divineness far escapes all human perception. But upon his individual works, he has engraved unmistakable marks of his glory, so clear and so prominent that even unlettered and stupid folk cannot plead the excuse of ignorance. The essence of God is incomprehensible. What does he mean by that? The essence of God is incomprehensible. But on... Well, but we do know something of God's nature from his works. We see his glory, his wisdom, his righteousness, these sorts of things.
That's the nature he's revealed to man.
Okay. Calvin is maybe not in the best language available to us today, but nevertheless accurately saying there's something about God which is transcendent and mysterious. In and of himself, there are things about God which we cannot know. They are incomprehensible. And we better keep that in mind, because he's going to tell us a few things about himself that we may have a hard time putting together, but that doesn't give us the right to reject them. The essence of God is incomprehensible. So how are we supposed to know God? We're not supposed to, through speculation and philosophy, try to get to the deep, mysterious, internal character of God. We'd rather know God as he is seen in his works. We know God in the language of the philosopher, the theologians, ob extra, that is, as he's shown himself externally. As God shows himself to us, not as he is in and of himself. Now, some neo-Orthodox theologians have picked up on Calvin here, and they've said what this means is that we cannot know God as he is, but only as he appears to us. There's a very vicious implication to that. Namely, that God is utterly mysterious, and it may be that how God appears is different from how he really is.
Wouldn't we care?
Sure we would. I mean, if it appears to us that by believing in Jesus Christ and following his commandments, we are acceptable to him and are members of his kingdom, and then it turns out God didn't even intend to save anybody, the difference between reality and the appearance of reality would be tragic. And so some theologians have tried to humble biblicists like myself and others who want to proof text a knowledge of God and say, but even Calvin realized we don't know God as he really is. We only know God as he appears to us. For Calvin, there was no suggestion that what God shows of himself ab extra, externally, is different from his essence. All he meant is God is not showing us everything about himself. There is a secret, mysterious, transcendent element to God's person, but it is perfectly consistent with how he shows himself to us. Our concentration should be on what? How God shows himself. God has manifested himself in the creation. His individual works, as well as the whole sweep of the system of creation, shows his glory. Maybe I'll come back to this. If you want to note this, you can do an interesting study of Calvin's use of Hebrews 11:3 at the bottom of the page. Because if you read Hebrews 11:3 in your English translation, it doesn't seem to be saying what Calvin is, how, my sentence is all garbled here. Calvin doesn't seem to be using it in the way that it was intended. We may come back to that if we have time later. Section 2, we've already commented upon innumerable evidences. Even the uneducated and untutored can see them. Calvin is, however, in favor of education. There is this sentence right in the middle of the page where he says, men who have either quaffed or even tasted the liberal arts penetrate with their aid far more deeply into the secrets of the divine wisdom. There's a real indictment of the university system today. Calvin says the more educated you become, the more you should recognize the wisdom of God. Education should lead us more and more to submit to God and to see his glory and his wisdom in the world round about us. As a matter of fact, though, the mark of an educated person today and what the universities are really pushing is to get away from attributing everything to God, to get away from seeing the wisdom of God in the created world or any area of life. Calvin says that the proper end of education, though, is to make us worship God all the more. Okay, this is kind of a cute thing, I think. I want to point out about Calvin. At the bottom of this page, he says, likewise, in regard to the structure of the human body, one must have the greatest keenness in order to weigh with gallant skill his articulation, symmetry, beauty, and use. You look at the created world, and you see all this evidence of God's workmanship. And Calvin says, and above all, if you want proof that God is the creator of things, look at what? The human body. He says, there's so much proof of that in the human body. And in his commentary on the Psalms, as the editor points out, Psalm 139, Calvin likewise makes these points and refers to the human body. David is, the verse in Psalm 139 is, my strength is not hid from thee, which thou hast made in secret. I was woven together in the lowest parts of the earth, meaning I was weaved together in my mother's womb. And Calvin comments, David no doubt means figuratively to express the inconceivable skill which appears in the formation of the human body. When we examine it, even to the nails on our fingers, there is nothing which could be altered without felt inconveniency, as at something disjointed or put out of place. And what then if we should make the individual parts the subject of enumeration? Where is the embroiderer who, with all his industry and ingenuity, could execute the hundredth part of this complicated and diversified structure? We need not then wonder if God, who formed man so perfectly in the womb, should have an exact knowledge of him after he is ushered into the world. Calvin says, if you just look at the human body, just look at the fingernails, he says. And in our reading, do you recall how he later refers to the toenails as evidence of God's workmanship? Yes, it's right here on page 56 about five lines down, well, in the third line, yet they set God aside, the while using nature, which for them is the artificer of all things, as a cloak. They see such exquisite workmanship in their individual members, from mouth and eyes, even to their very toenails. And yet they attribute this to nature. Calvin says, when you're arguing with somebody, remember he's got a human body. I mean, how does he think this human body all fits together and works if God didn't make it this way? Even down to the point of the fingernails and toenails. There's another one of those little cute questions I'll be asking from time to time. What was the height of the natural evidence of God's workmanship in the human body? Toenails and fingernails for Calvin, so it seems. So the human... Well, I think both take place, but Calvin's suggesting that that you do immediately in seeing the complicated integration of the human body know that it was made by God. He also suggests the liberal arts, the more you study it, deepens that conception that only God could make something that wondrous. But I think he is suggesting that, I mean, how do people imagine that it comes about that we can do this? If you give me just a minute here before we stop, he refers to something on page 55 that I'll bet most of you just read over and said, what do you mean by that? If you look into it, though, he has a specific argument. He says, I'm now four lines down. Well, he quotes the psalmist, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings thou hast established strength. Indeed, he not only declares that a clear mirror of God's works is in humankind, but that infants, while they nurse at their mother's breast, have tongues so eloquent to preach his glory that there is no need at all of other orators. Calvin says the very cries of infants are evidence that God made us. You don't need orators, Calvin says. The very crying of infants speaks of a God. Now, how is that so? Well, I did a little research for you on that matter, and it turns out that in his commentary on the Psalms, on Psalm 8, which we have just read, Psalm 8:2, Calvin has this to say. He now enters upon the proof of the subject which he had undertaken to discourse upon, declaring that the providence of God, in order to make itself known to mankind, does not wait till men arrive at the age of maturity, but even from the very dawn of infancy shines forth so brightly as is sufficient to confute all the ungodly who through their profane contempt of God would wish to extinguish his very name. Well, Calvin's not giving us any Thomas Aquinas natural theology here. He says, look, infants can disprove all these people. How so? The opinion of some who think that, he gets into a technical matter here. Okay, the meaning, therefore, is that God, in order to commend his providence, has no need of the powerful eloquence of rhetoricians, nor even of distinct and formed language, because the tongues of infants, although they do not as yet speak, are ready and eloquent enough to celebrate it. But it may be asked, in what sense does he speak of children as the proclaimers of the glory of God? That's what you've been asking, right? What does he mean by this? In my judgment, those reason very foolishly who think that this is done when children begin to articulate, because then also the intellectual faculty of the soul shows itself. Granting that they are called babes or infants, even until they arrive at their seventh year, how can such persons imagine that those who now speak distinctly are still hanging on the breast? Calvin says, look, it says here that suckling children are able to do this. So he says it's not just when they begin to talk that they are evidence of the divine. Maybe. Let's see, though. Nor is there any more propriety in the opinion of those who say that the word for babes and sucklings are here put allegorically for the faithful who, being born again by the Spirit of God, no longer retain the old age of the flesh. Calvin says, don't give me this spiritual interpretation. I take this in just what it says here. that children, before they're able to speak, are proof of the divine glory. What need, then, is there to wrest the words of David when their true meaning is so clear and suitable? He says that babes and sucklings are advocates sufficiently powerful to vindicate the providence of God. Why does he not entrust this business to men, but to show that the tongues of infants, even before they are able to pronounce a single word, speak loudly and distinctly in commendation of God's liberality towards the human race? Whence is it that nourishment is ready for them as soon as they are born, but because God wonderfully changes blood into milk? Whence also have they the skill to suck, but because the same God has, by a mysterious instinct, fitted their tongues for doing this? David, therefore, has the best reason for declaring that although the tongues of all who have arrived at the age of manhood should become silent, the speechless mouth of infants is sufficiently able to celebrate the praise of God. And when he not only introduces babes as witnesses and preachers of God's glory, but also attributes mature strength to their mouth, the expression is very emphatic. It means the same thing as if he had said, "These are invincible champions of God, who, when it comes to the conflict, can easily scatter and discomfit the whole host of the wicked despisers of God and those who have abandoned themselves to impiety." We should observe against whom he imposes upon infants the office of defending the glory of God, namely against the hardened despisers of God who dare to raise up against heaven to make war upon God, as the poets have said in olden time of the giants. What's the argument? He says, look, how is it? How does it come about that infants have milk to desire? In a chance universe, when an infant's born, why should his mother's breast prepare, Calvin says, blood turned into milk? How is it that infants are born with this natural instinct for sucking? I mean, isn't that interesting? And this happens right on the delivery table. The infant's taken from the mother's womb and put to the mother's breast, and the infant begins to suck on the breast. Well, Calvin says, in that very thing, right out of the mouth of babes and sucklings, God has ordained strength. And so Calvin sees everywhere in the human body, even in the mouth of infants, the proof of God's creating the world and making it all work together harmoniously. It's all there, and yet, in closing, I have to remind you, Calvin will say, it's not going to lead men to the true God. Because not only is God constantly giving this evidence of his glory and majesty, showing that he is the creator, at the same time, men are constantly corrupting it, constantly pushing it down, constantly turning it into something else, so that they won't have to be led to worship the living and true God. We haven't come to that yet, but I just remind you that that's where Calvin is going in this chapter. We'll finish chapter 5 next time, I promise you. I'll move a little bit faster, and we'll take, let me see how far chapter 6 goes. Let's try to do 5, 6, and 7 for next time. If you... there's a lot in 7 that will probably take us to the lesson beyond, but for our upcoming lesson, prepare sections, chapters 5, 6, and 7. Doug?
What's the Latin term proficare and non-proficare in relation to the knowledge of God?
The terms have to do with what man is able to do. Before the fall, man was able to sin and able not to sin. After the fall, man is not able not to sin. And in heaven, we will not be able to sin.
And then what do you read, right? There are many people that... the believer is able, whatever that means, but I wasn't sure that whether the believer ever actually did so, to live about possible sin. I was concerned about that statement.
Well, there are people who maintain that the believer is able today to live a sinless life, at least for periods of time. But that would not be true to Reformed theology. Reformed theology denies the possibility of moral perfection in this life. It is the goal and what we're to strive for, but it's not something which we will enjoy until we are glorified and with Christ in heaven. We're going to talk about a lot of these theological things as we go through. And I promise next time we'll try to make a little more progress.
What would be your position on the argument that when the soul enters the body, is it at conception, or is it a quickening, or prior to? Is it
This may perhaps mystify you and create more questions out of the one, but my view is that the soul doesn't enter the body, because that's not the biblical view of the soul. See, it's a Platonic conception of the soul that leads you to ask, well, now, when is this vase filled with water, as it were? When is this body now infused with the soul? You see, does it come at conception, at quickening, at birth, or at the age of maturity, at baptism, or, you know, whenever? When does the body receive the soul? And I would say that man is a special kind of body. That man is ensouled, that is to say, he is a person from the very beginning. And that's not true of a plant or an animal or anything like that. Man doesn't have a soul, man is a soul. Man is a person rather than having body and person or body and soul. Again, that probably raises a lot more questions than you had intended, but so I don't answer the question. No, I don't. I do believe that the intermediate state is a great mystery, however. Since God made man an ensouled body, or a body with special moral and spiritual capabilities, the intermediate state is the mystery. The resurrection state is the natural one. And a lot of traditional theology has reversed it. They've made the intermediate state, oh, everybody understands that. Soul goes to heaven. I mean, that's what we really are. We're souls, you know. And then how can there be a resurrection and so forth? And the Bible is the other way around. The resurrection state is what we expect, you know, for man. When Paul speaks of the intermediate state, it really mystifies him. All he can say is, well, I'm absent from the body but present with the Lord. And he talks about another tabernacle being provided for him. You mean he'll have a body in heaven that God provides? Well, no, I don't think so. But Paul struggles with the intermediate state for a way to describe it. But you know, John, Paul, Peter, none of them have any difficulty with the idea of the resurrection body. That's the way things are supposed to be. So I do believe that our person will somehow mysteriously survive our body, but that we are not made up of two things somehow glued together, body and soul. Rather, we have a body that's not like the apes and the plants and other things that are alive. We have a body that makes moral decisions and has a relationship with God.
But there is a heart-mind distinction in Calvin and Reformed theology?
Heart-mind? Well, for purposes of making a distinct emphasis on, how can I put it? The things which you know from the heart are genuine. The things which you know only with the mind are things which you might be able to say the answers to, say it with the lip, but you don't say it from the heart. So that's important for distinguishing between dead orthodoxy, hypocrisy, and other sorts of spiritual diseases. But it's not so much to say there are parts of the human person, the heart part and the soul part and the mind part.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the ones that I'm thinking of today would want to deny that that's their view. Man is totally depraved, mind and heart, but in their apologetic, you are exactly right. They say, You can count on the natural man's mind to come to a right knowledge of God. The difficulty is his heart's so corrupt that he won't want to. It's a problem of will, not intellect, where Van Til and I think Calvin, I especially think Paul would say, no, it's a matter of the whole man. He's led to vain reasoning and a senseless heart. Both.
His body is more than just a mechanical device.
In the case of man, sure. Sure. And Calvin does too.
Separate from the soul, not separate from the soul.
I would say that what we mean by the soul is the person or personality. There are personal bodies and there are impersonal bodies.
What I mean by soul is that energy that goes to heaven.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem. When we think of entity that goes to heaven, we probably think of a ghost that leaves the machine and goes to heaven in Platonic fashion. And I would say my body will be in the tomb and my person will be with God, but that doesn't mean that there have been people who thought you could weigh the body at the point of death and you could tell when the soul left because there would be a slight variation in weight. Now, I mean, that's a very crass way of taking the soul leaving the body, but I mean, it all amounts to the same thing. There's something in man that departs from the body. Well, you know, very few people have studied philosophy, and many who have don't even get this point. When you talk about a soul leaving the body, you're not thinking of the soul as immaterial. You're thinking of it as a physical object. Now, I know you may say that you don't, but only physical objects leave things. You see, souls don't have spatial location, do they? Minds don't have spatial location. I'll give you an example. We might say, when I stand up, that Bonson's brain is 5 feet 9 inches off the ground. I mean, provided you think I have one. That would make sense to say the brain of that individual is 6 feet or 6'5" or 5'10" or whatever off the ground. But it doesn't make sense to say his mind is 5'10" off the ground. Because a mind is, in its very nature, not spatially located. It doesn't have material properties like that. A mind is an ability to do certain things. A brain is a organ, a physical.
Are the angels and demons located then?
That depends on whether you think that they have physical bodies or not. I think they do have physical bodies.
No, but not necessarily. But physical doesn't necessarily mean atomic. They're not just bolts of atoms that can be found on the periodic table. Or if they're another kind of physical, then they're atomic.
I don't know. I'm not sure what the bodies of angels are made up of.
Those same people say that weighed the body to see if the soul left. Would they also say that stupid people weigh less than intelligent people as a relationship?
Oh, I don't think it's a matter of intelligence. It's a matter of spirituality. There may be some people that are thin-souled and some people that are thick-souled. We'll talk more about anthropology as we get to that. Right now, let's just stick with the knowledge of God, the Creator, known to all men, and which Calvin says men are suppressing.